Thanks, blessings, Zulu. Good evening, Zimbabwe. It's 17 hours 20 UTC, 7:20 p.m. in Zimbabwe on Saturday, January 3rd, 2015. You are listening to Studio 7 live from the Voice of America in Washington. Thank you for joining us live from Washington. This is Gibbs Dube. Here are our top stories this evening. A constitutional law expert says Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa is in a position to assume power in the event that President Robert Mugabe is incapacitated.
The constitution, I think, is clear on what should happen. The person who is the acting president at the time a vacancy arises is the one who takes over for up to 90 days.
Dumiso Gilbert Machazi, who was supposed to compile the late Cabinet Minister Enos Kalla's memos after his death, says it was going to be difficult for him to defend some contents of the project.
I said to myself, well, it would not be fair for me to remain defending that thing after Mr. Nkaram uncle was laid. It would have been better for him to be there to say, yes, I said it, knowing the courage that he lived by.
And will newly promoted Cholocho Football Club host Premier Soccer League matches in their dusty backyard? Stay tuned. A constitutional law expert says Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa is in a position to assume power in the event that President Robert Mugabe is incapacitated. Dr. Alex Makaisa of the University of Kent in Britain says ZANU-PF conflicts can derail the succession of the president in case something happens to the 90-year-old leader. He speaks to Studio 7 about President Mugabe's succession, the vice presidency, and First Lady Grace Mugabe's political role in succession issues.
The constitution, I think, is clear on what should happen. The person who is the acting president at the time a vacancy arises is the one who takes over for up to 90 days as acting president. And within that period, the political party, which was represented by the exiting president, will sit down and select a successor. Now, what is not clear here is how that political party goes about selecting the successor. And I would say that this is a potential problem.
Now, is there any way they can do it, you know, without causing so many problems?
Well, perhaps obvious answer to this, if you ask them, is that they will hold an extraordinary congress at which an election of the successor will be held. Presumably the person who will be elected as the president of the party will then become the shoe-in or the candidate to take over in terms of the national constitution. But this is all speculation. What would be useful is a more clear procedure into how a person is selected in those political parties so that it's clear before the event as opposed to people having to improvise when circumstances require that it be done.
Do you anticipate the process will be as smooth as what happened, say, in Nigeria when President Umaro Yar'Adua died, and in Malawi with Bingu Mutharika, and most probably the two unfortunate cases of Zambia, Levi Manasa and Michael Sata, where the vice presidents were sworn in within hours?
Well, it would be very clear if it was clear in ZANU-PF itself as to who tends to succeed the president should a vacancy arise. But as it stands, there is no clarity there. Indeed, the original constitution as created by COPAC had a very clear provision which said that the first vice president would succeed the exiting president and serve the remaining part of his term. That was a very clear provision which applies in Nigeria, applies in Malawi, applies in Zambia and many other countries. Unfortunately, I think because of the succession politics that was being fought within ZANU-PF, the national constitution, I think, became compromised, and therefore the eventual compromise between the political parties, which is a pity, was that the political party which sponsors the existing president will be given the power to select its own candidate. And I think that there is a potential problem because the method by which the political party chooses the successor is not known, And there can be all sorts of conflicts there, which will leave us in a very, very difficult position.
And now the issue of the next elections. We know that the next election is not until 2018. And some are wondering if President Mugabe, who will be 94 at that time, will be fit to contest. Now, as an hypothetical question, can he choose not to run?
If President Mugabe feels that he no longer wishes to run for presidency in 2018, then of course he can step aside. I don't think he's forced by his political party or by the national constitution to contest in that election. But I suppose if the president resigns or decides to step aside, he will be able to control that process and there will be a smoother transition than, you know, we fear.
First Lady Grace Mugabe has proved to be quite a force in the ZANU-PF party. But do you see her being a force if President Mugabe is not there?
What has happened in the last few months is not new in the history of nations or the history of the people. If you look at China, for example, Madame Mao tried to do the same thing during the last days of Chairman Mao when he was very powerful, but it didn't end very well for her. If you go to Ghana, President Jerry Rawlings, his wife, was also very powerful. If you go to the Ivory Coast, Babo, the wife was also very powerful. It's natural that she is ambitious. She thinks that she's been associated with power and therefore she can use that power to claim space for herself.
That was constitutional law expert Alex Makaisa of the University of Kent in Britain speaking with Studio 7.
Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA.
Dumiso Gilbert Machazi, who was supposed to compile the late cabinet minister Enos Nkala's memoirs after his death, says it was going to be difficult for him to defend some contents of the project. Machazi, who abandoned writing a book about the late controversial politician, speaks with Studio 7's Chris Gande about the aborted book.
I had my questions ready, and I said to myself, well, it would not be fair for me to remain defending that thing after Mr. Nkala's uncle was late. It would have been better for him to be there to say, yes, I said it, knowing the courage that he lived by. It was better for him to defend it than for me, as the author, to be the one responsible and probably be accused of even lying in his absence.
Now, from the little that you heard from him, what can you tell us, especially about his relationship with President Robert Mugabe?
They shared a cell for 10 years, I think, in the places where they were kept by the regime. So they became very close. They knew a lot of things about each other. There are many things Nkala knew about, a lot of things about the origin of the president, according to him. And he knew some things that were deeply personal, that he had not here, was only going to start telling me when we started writing. So unfortunately, we didn't do the project long enough for me to get there. But he knew a lot of things, and he just felt that maybe, and because of the respect I think that he had for the president, he didn't want these things revealed by him whilst the president was alive or while he was alive. So that's why I was insisting that it's better for them to be revealed after he was gone. But I felt it was unfair for me then to carry the burden of all that information and defend the truthfulness and the veracity of that information in his absence.
Now, can you tell us the little bit that he talked about the late Vice President Joshua Nkomo?
There were two major things. One was that he felt that people had given the late VP a lot of power, which made him not respect or listen to his subordinates, even though he had placed the places where they should give him the information givers to him. So that was one issue. And a time came, even quoted in Komo's book, The Story of My Life, where he talks about Malienga passing a note that was saying they must get rid of this Mundewere. There was a general discontent in the party about the person Joshua Nkomo by a number of people, a relatively large fraction. So the attitude was, it was like anti-Nkomo. And so Enos Nkala said, what kind of a party is called anti-Nkomo? If you want to form another party, let's form another party. And if you're afraid to form it in your houses, come to my house and form it.
That was caller Dumiso Gilbert Machazi speaking with Studio 7 from Johannesburg, South Africa. It's now time for the Women's Forum.
Welcome to the Women's Forum, a forum where we look at issues affecting women, hosted by Marvelous Nhlanga Nyahuye from Washington. Today we have the pleasure of speaking to Gladys Hlatshwayo, a political analyst, who will take us through some of the major highlights of the women's movement in 2014 and how women would like to see some of these challenges that were faced by women addressed in this new year, 2015. Welcome to the Women's Forum, Ms. Hlatshwayo.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Hlatshwayo, 2014 has been a very interesting year, especially when we look at the women's movement in Zimbabwe. What would you say were the major highlights?
I think 2014 was a very difficult year for the women's movement. Firstly, when we look in terms of the economy of our nation, I think as women we bear the brunt because we are the people who are supposed to be looking for food. We are the people who are supposed to be providing the food for the family. And 2014, in terms of the economy, was really a bad year. A lot of companies were closing. Things were getting tight by day. And as a result, we really had to face all of these challenges in terms of fending for our families.
What about on the political front? What would you say were some of the major highlights when it comes to the women's movement in Zimbabwe in 2014?
In terms of politics, I think 2014 was the year that we saw the woman who was in the presidium, Joyce Mujuru, being outed. And in as much as we have differences with her politically and some of the roles that she played in the country in terms of violence and all, but I think the fact that she was also a woman who was in the presidium, and that was some sign in terms of women empowerment. And then we saw that we now have an all-men presidium. I think that was actually a regression in terms of women empowerment, in terms of women participation in political processes. And even if you look at the numbers in terms of the cabinet that we have, and also if you look at the numbers in terms of representation of women in political parties such as ZANU-PF, you would then be left wondering whether people really take issues of gender quite seriously. So we really have work to do going into 2015.
Going into 2015, what do you think needs to change, especially when we look at the women's movement and how literally women are perceived right now in the country?
I think what we saw in 2014 is a reflection of the quality of leadership that we have in Zimbabwe and the ideals that they hold dear. And definitely gender equality is not one of them. So for me, we need to actually look at the whole system that we have in Zimbabwe, the governance system that we have, and possibly work towards overhauling it. Because as it stands, it's not benefiting anyone and it's not benefiting women at the levels that I spoke to earlier on, that is in terms of the politics and even in terms of how women are faring on a day-to-day basis, their struggles to fend for their families and all. So I think 2015 should really be about looking at the governance system that we have in Zimbabwe and really working towards overhauling that system and to change the mentality that people have around gender equality issues.
How do you propose that this kind of attitude that people already have be changed as you look forward to 2015?
My proposal really is not to look at the gender issue in isolation of the challenges that we are facing in Zimbabwe. I think the governance question that we have been facing ever since the 2000s must be addressed, and we must, from all walks of life, women, men, children, you know, people coming from different interest groups, they must realize that we have a serious governance problem in our country. And it's unfortunate that it's also reflecting in terms of gender equality issues. But this is a broader a problem that we are facing. And I think we need concerted efforts from all stakeholders, women included, to look at this governance crisis that we have in our country.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gladys Hlatshwayo. Unfortunately, time is not on our side. I would like to thank you for having been our guest on the Women's Forum, a forum where we look at issues affecting women.
Thank you very much.
The Women's Forum is hosted by Marvelous Mhlanga Nyahuye in Washington.
Thanks very much, Marvelous Mhlanga Nyahuye. We hope you are going to have a wonderful weekend. In sports news, the newly promoted Cholocho Football Club are expected to host Premier Soccer League matches in their dusty backyard. We speak to soccer commentator Ezra Chisaspanda about the club's challenges in hosting big clubs like Dynamos, Highlanders, Caps United and others.
They'll have to move from Cholocho, come in and play in Bulawayo, or have a venue or home ground in Bulawayo. They'd load a huge fan base in Cholocho. They will pack that ground, 2,000-3,000 people. But when they come to Bulawayo, it means they're playing in empty ground. Because most of the people here, they are backing teams like Highlanders. So it would be struggling for Cholocho to maintain its status in the Premier League or beat teams like Dynamos and Highlanders and all that. But if they prepare very well and get some experience, a few experienced players to steady the ship, they might survive and they might give these big guys a run of their money. So we hope that Cholocho will do well.
And what do you make of the players, the caliber of the players?
Yes, the players have done so well in the lower league, but this is the premiership. So what I'm saying, Chris, is that if, for instance, they try to look for some experienced players who have played in the premiership before to aid into those youngsters playing for Cholocho, they will do well.
That was soccer commentator Ezra Swanda speaking with Studio 7's Chris Gande from Bulawayo. And now an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than a year after the largest Ebola epidemic ever recorded began in a remote part of Guinea, and 5 months after it was recognized as a public health emergency of international concern, there is still much to be done to stop the outbreak, a top American health official said after returning from the three most affected nations. Dr. Thomas Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, returned to the U.S. from West Africa on December 21st, where he spoke with patients and doctors, met with many of the CDC's 170 staff members in the region, and met with the presidents, health ministers, and Ebola coordinators in each country. He described the situation as both inspiring and sobering. It is inspiring to see how much better the response has become in the past 2 months, how much international commitment there is, and, most importantly, how hard people from each of the three countries are working to stop Ebola, Dr. Frieden said. But it is sobering that Ebola continues to spread rapidly in Sierra Leone and that in parts of Monrovia and Conakry, Ebola is spreading unabated. Improvements in contact tracing are urgently needed. At a briefing held to discuss the results of his trip to Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, Dr. Frieden described progress in some areas but continued growth in Ebola cases in others. In Liberia, the outbreak has slowed dramatically, and at the moment, the country has the upper hand against the virus, in part due to improvements in access to Ebola treatment units and community care centers, safe burials, and community engagement, he said. But the outbreak continues to surge in Sierra Leone, and there has been a troubling spread in Guinea's capital city. We've got a long way to go, and this is no time to relax our grip on the response. The recent approval of $1.2 billion to strengthen international response and preparedness is crucial to stopping Ebola and improving global capacity to prevent, detect, and quickly respond to health threats like Ebola in the future. As the United States and its partners continue to mobilize against the disease, we are also considering how to ensure that our immediate response measures contribute to long-term capacity to protect against infectious disease threats.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Of Kustman coming to you live from the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Now to recap today's top stories. A constitutional law expert says Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa is in a position to assume power in the event that President Robert Mugabe is incapacitated. And to miso Gilbert Machazi, who was supposed to compile the late Cabinet Minister Enos Nkala's memos after his death, says it was going to be hard for him to defend some contents of the project. That's our broadcast this evening. Now stand by for Studio 7 in Ndebele. This is Gibbs Dube in Washington, wishing you a pleasant evening and a prosperous 2015. Good night, Zimbabwe.
Siyabonga Gibbs Dube. Siyalambulela emsakazweni we Studio 7 omgqibelo omhla ka